Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. My guest today is writer Monica Byrne, whose debut novel, The Girl in the Road, is set in a future where global powers have shifted east. Two women travel to the same point on Earth from opposite directions and nearly 30 years apart, their journeys, their history, and their fate intertwined. Both women are fleeing something traumatic, something violent, something they've each repressed, but something that's lurking just under the surface, about to raise its viper head on occasion. The stories of the two women form a narrative of many sorts, a coming-of-age story, a road novel, a hero's journey with a desire for salvation. It's also one of the most intriguing things I read in 2014, definitely one of my favorites. And it seems like it's been a favorite with plenty of other people as well, because it's just been nominated for the Kitschies Debut Novel Award. Monica Byrne has been a playwright and was almost an astronaut. She's joining me today from North Carolina, where she lives and writes when she's not traveling. Monica, welcome to Midnight in Karachi, and thank you so much for joining me today. There's so much to celebrate about The Girl in the Road, and one of those things is diversity. Diversity is on a lot of people's minds right now, whether it's about religion, about sexuality, about culture, about gender. You chose a queer woman of color as your protagonist, and you know, she was a totally different ethnicity than you. You set your story in the future of a country that you were probably only familiar to as a tourist. You dealt with a religion you didn't grow up with. These are all crucial choices in telling the story. They're also very hard choices to make and to balance sensitively. So why did you make them?
I made them because I feel like the vast majority of English language literature that I encounter is so white. And that is just such an artificial representation of the human race as a whole. And I feel like we're moving increasingly into a more global society. And I wanted my hero, my heroine of my novel, to represent the actual most common phenotype of the human race, which is a brown-skinned woman. And I felt as though that was a tremendous risk, because I am not a brown-skinned woman, and at the same time worth the risk if I trusted myself to do the necessary research and have the necessary mindfulness, because I consider my position as a white person to be one that comes with a lot of responsibility. I mean, and that's my interpretation of whiteness. I wouldn't say that is for everybody or necessarily everybody's responsibility. I consider it my responsibility on behalf of people I know and love and on behalf of my own humanization to make literature look like the entire world instead of a very small portion of it. When I first started writing, the protagonist was a man and his name was Toby. And he was Indian, but he was male. And then I asked myself, why is there any reason that this character needs to be male? And there wasn't any reason, of course. And so Toby became Mina. And then Mina had a girlfriend named Mohini. And then Mohini turned out to have been born a man, or biologically so. It was important for me to make literature diverse in a way I just wasn't seeing, to tell the stories I wasn't reading and feel like needed to be out there.
That's interesting. You started off with a man. Why? Was that the first character that came to you when you were writing the story, was of a man?
Yeah, it was. I think it was the character of Mariama, whose name was Yamaya, actually, in the beginning. That character came to me, and then just like someone who was walking across the ocean on this floating pontoon bridge, and that turned out to be in my head, like, well, of course, I couldn't imagine a woman hero because there are no prototypes for me. So of course it was a man. And then I really started asking myself, I don't know if you read this part, but the person who convinced me not to make it a man was my gynecologist.
Really?
Yes, because I was having a checkup before leaving for Ethiopia and India, and he was, you know, making sure everything was all right. And he was like, so what's your book about? And I was like, oh, well, it's about this man who walks across the ocean on a floating pontoon bridge, and he has a very intense experience of the travel. And he was like, why don't you make it a woman? Because then she can get her period on the trail and it would be really interesting. And I was like, you're right, man. You're right. I just to write that scene, getting her period on the trail. And it's actually a very small scene in The Girl on the Road. She just like, she gets it and she deals with it. And then that's the end. But just to deal with the lived reality of being in a female body on the road is something, again, that was super important to me.
It's also very interesting because it's not just about getting her period, all her other bodily functions, things that are often ignored when you have a road novel or where you have a novel about a hero's journey or whatever you want to call it. Not to go into too much detail about these things, but she does deal with them. And it's not like you focus on it because it's just matter of fact. And it is matter of fact. All these things are things we deal with, you know, all the time. But they do get ignored quite a bit in fiction, which is, it was interesting to me that you dealt with all of that.
Yeah, to me it was essential to show that because traveling and caretaking, self-caretaking, is an essential part of travel to me, an essential part of self-mothering. Like, I'm remembering being in Costa Rica and it was a really rainy night in Monteverde, and so I was just in my hotel room and several of my skirts were torn. And so I just stayed up with the storms raging outside and just sewed up my skirts again. And I had this profound moment of like, this is what it is. It's like building your home wherever you go on the road. And that aspect, again, like taking care of a period, taking care of every bodily aspect, every health aspect, was crucial, actually, to Mina's development.
I read an interview online just a couple of days ago in which you said that you were absolutely working, I quote, absolutely working from a place of privilege within a colonialist mindset. We were talking about this a little earlier off air, as it were. This isn't something that's easy to break free of. Just as I was saying, you know, I have my issues with privilege, you have yours. Everyone in the world has some level of those when they come from a certain sort of background, as it were. Being on either side, the colonizer or the colonized, as the case is for some of us, this affects your imagination, your internal narrative, how you see yourself and how you see the world. So how do you personally break free of that? How do you move away from that?
I'm honestly not sure it's possible to break free. This is a recurring question to me. I mean, the post Eating the Other that I wrote about on my blog, basically, to sum up, I'm asking myself whether coming from a consumerist capitalist society like the US, whether it's possible for me to have any relationship to other cultures besides that of consumer. Because in a certain way, for example, going to Iran, going to the Philippines, going to any of these places, has this dark undertone of feeling like shopping. and that cultures are commodities, and that I am picking and choosing various aspects of the cultures that I like and then carrying them with me and becoming a sort of bag lady. And like that is the most cynical interpretation of what I'm doing, but I think that's also just something I need to constantly be aware of. And I mean, for example, the pieces about Iran that have been coming out, like I just got an email from a guy, I think in Iran, or at least of Iranian descent, and he was like, reconciliation with who? Because our Ayatollah, you know, did all of these awful things, and please open your eyes and don't be so naive. And that's completely fair. I mean, my experience in Iran was, of course, very filtered and very sheltered. And so I think with the places I feel particularly drawn to, which are India, Belize, and Iran so far, I have a responsibility to be clear-eyed about everything about the culture instead of like just the parts I like, and report them honestly and listen to people in them. I honestly don't know whether it's possible to break free just to act most responsibly from within the position. But I'll keep you posted. Like, I'm really trying to figure out whether that's possible.
Maybe the thing to do is just have an awareness about, or just think of these questions as you're saying, something that stays in your mind. So maybe the thing to do is have an awareness that these questions exist, as opposed to, you know, coming to a conclusion.
Yes. I mean, awareness is the baseline. And I actually sometimes wonder whether it's also the ultimate goal, because even if you're enlightened, right, we still live in a really racist society, and you still have to act from within that and not act as if you're in a post-racial society. Like, you have to balance dual awarenesses that you feel post-racial, but not in a post-racial society.
Okay, so about some of the motifs that ran through the book. You know, I was reading it a second time when I sat down to review it, and I found further hidden elements, things that I really enjoy that on second read, when things sort of, that perhaps I was reading too fast and or too furiously or not carefully enough the first time, to discover these things that come up, the hidden treasures, as it were. Did these things sort of come through organically for you, or was there a lot of crafting and revising and rewriting of the book?
Oh, I can never tell from one passage to the next. When I read it now, like, I have to make myself remember what came easily and what didn't. And there's this amazing quote by Frank Herbert where he says the same thing. Like, when he looks back at his prose, he can't tell what he wrote on a bad day versus what he wrote on a good day. And to me, that's so reassuring. And that's still the case with me now. Like, I can't tell what passages I wrote when I was just feeling really loose and easy. But it was a mixture of both, to answer your question. It was a mixture of both. And I mean, I write morning pages every morning. And so once I got into Mina's head, I could just start writing in her stream of consciousness. And she is actually based strongly on the singer Michelle Ndigiochelo. And so before I ever wrote chapters with her in it, I would read interviews with Michelle Ndigiochelo to, like, get me in her mindset. So that was one thing that I did to prepare whenever I wrote Mina's passages.
That's one fantastic role model to have, because I adore her music as well.
Oh, you know, I love her so much. I love her. And I thank her in the acknowledgments. And I don't know if anyone's put the book into her hands yet. Like, I just, she's really private, and I don't want to, like, push it on her. But, and like, that's the thing with famous people, or people, I won't even say famous people, but people you idolize. Like, there are very few people that I feel nervous around, and she would be one of them. I would just be terrified. I'd just be like, you don't know how much you mean to me. But, like, how can you say that to a person? Like, what does a person say back to that, except to just be gracious? But it's very alienating.
Now, the Girl in the Road has these, we were just talking about, you know, people you idolize or famous people. It has these amazing blurbs by science fiction fantasy writers Neil Gaiman, John Scalzi, and yet it wasn't really, from what I can tell, marketed as science fiction. It is, and it isn't, and that's one of the things that I liked about it a great deal. So making that decision as to which publisher to go with, how that publisher would market your book, I mean, these are all things that a smart writer has to consider, obviously. That's the business of you know, writing and bookselling as well. What were you thinking about, you know, when your agent for example, pitching the book? Did you have ideas where you wanted it to go, how you wanted it to be pushed?
Yes, and I made it very, very clear to Sam in the beginning, and that was one of the reasons why I chose him instead of other agents, was that I wanted it pitched to literary publishers. And just front up acknowledging the divide, the quote-unquote divide, the quote-unquote distinction is so stupid in any meaningful sense except the marketing sense. In which case, it's everything. And I was just thinking about my heroes, Ursula K. Le Guin and Kim Stanley Robinson, who I feel are so unfairly pigeonholed, and because they started in science fiction, and so they became marginalized and became ghettoized within the larger science, within the larger literary community. And that continues to make me so angry. I mean, Ursula K. Le Guin just gave that amazing speech at the National Book Awards, but she's like 85, and it took them that long to give it to her? Like, honestly, she's been amazing for years. And so, like, and I always wonder about, like, why she isn't on the Nobel Prize list. You know, things like that, just, I don't even understand. And so I wanted to start off by saying, I am both. I am both. And I already had a very strong foot in the science fiction community because of going to Clarion and because of having lots of friends in the community. And so I thought that going literary with the publication of the book would bring both communities together. So it was both of those things. It was not wanting to be pigeonholed, and it was wanting to just bridge the gap and destroy it entirely.
You mentioned Clarion just now. Did going there, being a part of that group, the sort of workshopping environment, how much did that form your writing?
I would say, I'm not sure how much it formed my writing, but it certainly taught me discipline, and it certainly gave me a community of cheerleaders. I mean, the connections and the friendships that I formed there are just priceless, and we're still all friends. You know, like, my class is really a really solid class and is doing really well. Do you know, like, Kat Howard, and Neil was one of our teachers, and they're just, like, it was a really strong class. And I felt like the most that I came away with it was the community. But in terms of my writing, I felt like it was already pretty strong. and that I was now validated going forward. And, like, from the teachers that I encountered there, I felt more confident going forward in my writing.
So you don't hold back at all on sex and violence, yet I didn't feel it was a shock jock approach. But even so, and without going into any spoiler territory, I'm pretty certain that you've ruffled at least a few people's feathers. Did you at all consider holding back when it came to writing some of the more sensitive scenes, both in terms of violence and sex? Did you ever have this feeling of someone, I don't know, a Sunday school teacher, a parent, an irate reader, like, looking over your shoulder as you typed away?
Well, the sex and the violence scenes, it must be said, they're very different in nature. And so a sex scene where mutual consensual pleasure was being exchanged, like, no, hell no. Like, that, you know, that needs to be there. But in terms of, like, child abuse scene, like, yeah, definitely. That was the most difficult scene to write in the whole book. And I mean, oh goodness. Just that is the most controversial scene in the whole book, and people have a lot of difficulty with it, and I don't blame them. And at the same time, to me, it was very important to tell the truth of what the lived experience of sexual abuse is, including years and years afterwards of venerating the abuser and not recognizing the abuse. Like, that happens all the time. And people get really upset at the truth of that. and I mean, one of the reasons that I chose the agent that I did was because he was the only one who said, leave that scene just as it is, because you're telling the truth. And everyone else said, you need to tone that down, you need to edit that somehow, you need to make it so that she's not really abusing her, like, you know. And I couldn't, because I would be lying about the story, and I would be lying about what millions of people experience and have experienced. So yeah,
for what it's worth, I think it should have stayed. I'm glad it did. Even though it was obviously a very harrowing scene to read, but I see why it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think and I've talked about this before, but the scene in Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Half of a Yellow Sun, which also has a really awful rape scene where, like, a beloved character participates in a gang rape. And I checked out after that scene, and I was so mad at him, and I was so mad at the author. And then that was super instructive to me. I was like, oh, I stopped caring about this person once he participated in a rape. That's actually really useful for me to know. You know what I mean? Like, I am also participating in a sort of dehumanization of this person who got caught up in war, not to excuse him, but that it is more instructive to me that people have strong reactions, and I would just urge them to examine their strong reactions.
From wanting to walk on Mars to writing, you went to you went to MIT, you attended a NASA academy, you were very much on the path to doing what you had wanted. And then to leave all of that behind, years of hard work and effort, obviously, and throw yourself into trying to make it by writing fiction, which, you know, is hard anywhere in the world. That's quite a major move for anyone to make. I mean, it's pretty gutsy.
Well, to be honest, once I decided to do that, it was the hugest relief. You can't imagine. I was like, oh, God, I don't have to do this anymore. Like, I don't have to pretend that this is what I want. And I don't have to pretend that this is what I enjoy. I can just do what I actually have fun doing. Like, that would be the most amazing thing. And I had great role models who helped me along with that, because my three of my four older siblings are working artists, or were at the time. And so I had models in place to just be like, go for it. And I had, you know, a few pieces under my belt where I was just like, I think writing comes really easily to me. And I have always wanted to write fiction. And so I should try it and see what happens. And I did, and it went really well, you know. I just, and now, oh my God, traveling the world and writing about it, it is my dream life, and I just want to keep living it for the rest of my life. And I have never for a second missed science.
Poor science. Poor science.
Well, I should also say I had a really terrible experience with my advisor in graduate school. Like, and to me, in retrospect, that was a blessing in disguise, because he was so awful and so overtly sexist. Like, he didn't take women into the field with him because he felt uncomfortable with women in the field. Like, this is the United States, 2004. And he, whatever. Anyway, he made it sort of easy for me to be like, I'm actually not willing to put up with the bullshit in this field. Like, I don't love science enough to put up with the bullshit. And there's plenty of bullshit in fiction, plenty. But I am willing to put up with it because they're my people now. And that is where I've made my home. Whereas with science, oh my God. Good luck, y'all.
You're a playwright too. Is your process for writing for the theater any different than writing fiction?
It certainly is.
In a novel form, I mean.
Oh, yeah. It's certainly different because I have a company with whom I work. My artistic director is Jay Obersky. It's a company called Little Green Pig Theatrical Concern. And basically, we've done this now 3 times. And so now we're coming back to the 4th time of just being like, what's on our minds? And we're sort of throwing around ideas and images and people we want to work with and influences, and it'll congeal into something. But it's definitely a collaboration. Whereas a novel is just like, I am the supreme leader of my own imaginative world, and I can communicate about it with other people, but it's funny, my conversations with my editor and agent are basically just like, trust me, it's going to be awesome. And that's all I can say. I can describe things to them and they're like, wow, that sounds weird. But I tell them, I mean, think about what The Girl in the Road sounded like. A woman walks across the ocean on a floating pontoon bridge. And God, I got a range of reactions to that. I mean, from everybody. I remember at Clarion, a publisher, I think it might have actually been a publisher from Tor, who she would listen to our elevator pitches and then give us feedback. And her feedback on my elevator pitch was really discouraging. So it sounds crazy. It sounds completely crazy when I say it. And I just have to trust that the people I'm working with are trusting me. Whereas in theater, it's a much more explicit relationship where we share a brain instead, and like we can see what's going on in each other's heads.
So it's been almost a year since The Girl in the Road was published. And we were talking about reactions to the elevator pitch, for example, in the initial conversations around the story when you were writing it or working on it. And now, all this time later, are the reactions different than what you expected? Are you still satisfied with the book that you wrote?
I am so happy that I got the opportunity to put out exactly the book I wanted. I mean, the editorial team and my agent were just a dream team in that respect. And the reactions that I've been getting have been, I'd say, 90% exactly what I was looking for, which is like, this is just something I've never read before. This is a bold new direction. This is, I don't know how to describe it. Like, I love all of that. I really love all of that. There is another segment of readers who, you know, just don't get it, don't like it, don't like being in the dark, don't like not knowing what's going on. But how can I write for them? You know, like I have to write to please me. And then that will translate to the audience that needs to read it. There's some of the reactions. I think the crankiest review was the NPR review, in my opinion. And he said something like, the book has too many ideas. And I'm not going to apologize for that. You know, like I love ideas. And to me, so much of literature, so much of contemporary literature suffers from a poverty of ideas. Is just rehashing the same ideas over and over. And they're not even ideas. They're just like settings. They're just like suburban Connecticut realism, adultery, disappointment with life stuff. I cannot deal with that kind of literature. And so to me, overstuffing a book with ideas is to me like paying homage to Borges, who, you know, when I read Borges, I'm just like, God, I could write a whole novel on every other idea this guy puts out. And I want my books to be like that.
It's funny that you said what you did about the poverty of ideas and the same idea being rehashed, because very often I come across, you know, and I read and review quite a bit of mainstream stuff as well, for lack of a better word, literary fiction, whatever those classifications may be. But very often you come across a series of books and they're all about white, middle class, depressed couples or people. I'm sorry, like, I mean, is this terribly a politically incorrect thing to say? But it's what you said. It's exactly the same people just having, like you said, it's either adultery or it's the same. And again, not to look down any of those problems that happen in real life. But we all go through those things in real life. Do I really want to just keep reading about them again and again? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know so much. They're so boring. And I want to experience art and literature that helps me see things in a new way or introduces me to things I haven't thought of yet, instead of just like very closely observed details of, like, I do that. I do that every day. It's called my morning pages. You know, again, like, we're agreeing. We're passionately agreeing here.
So I want to talk a little bit about your fantastic travels to Iran recently, which quite literally, as I was telling you, is my motherland, because my maternal grandparents came from there to Karachi in the early 30s or late 20s, rather, and they were Persian Zoroastrians. I've never been to Iran. And it was fascinating to me that you said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I don't know of very many writers who have taken such... Well, you've taken a lot of trips, let's say, for your research and a lot of detailing, which is fantastic. So you go to Iran, and it's lovely to see all these pictures that you're putting up and read your blogs. But what was that experience really like?
It was... I did not expect to connect with the country and the people to the extent that I did. I have always identified very closely with places, with sense of place. And the places with which I connect most are always humid tropical jungle climates. So Kerala in south of India and Belize, for example. And so I was like, you know, Iran's going to be, it's going to be this great experience, but it's like cold desert mountains, And, you know, the religious restrictions are probably going to, be difficult for me to deal with. And they just, none of that mattered. I was just blown away by the kindness, by the curiosity, by the consideration, by the mutual respect of the culture, by people I met who were so curious about me. And to this day, like, I'm getting every day U.S. friends who are saying, wasn't it dangerous or didn't you feel scared? And I didn't for one second. The whole time I was in Iran, I never felt scared or threatened or anything. And if I ever did, I made it a point to, for example, there was a delegation. I don't know what they were in town for. It might have been for Muharram, but there was a delegation in town in Shiraz who were sharing the hotel I was at. And, you know, there's some like looks back and forth, and I could tell they were probably from somewhere in North Africa. And, you know, they were looking at me like a young white woman traveling alone or eating breakfast alone. What's that all about? And then finally we were watching the Muharram parade together, and I just turned to them and asked them, where are you from? And they're like, oh, we're from Libya. And I was like, oh, cool. And they said, where are you from? And I said, America. And they're like, oh, welcome and come to Libya. You know, it's just people, individual people are infinitely more kind and generous than our crazy nation states. And getting to experience that was such a blessing. And coming back and like listening to the talks in Vienna or reading the news about the Iran nuclear talks, I'm so angry. And I'm not even Iranian. I'm so angry on behalf of the people I know and who I met there. Like, the entire country is in stasis because of the sanctions. And an entire generation of highly educated, passionate, incredible people is just kept there, like in a cage almost, because Iran is so cut off from the rest of the world. And that just makes me so angry for them and sad for us. Like, that, and when I say us, I mean the rest of the world, but especially Americans who just don't know any better, because all we hear is stupid propaganda on U.S. media.
Do you think this will all in some way or the other inform your next book?
Absolutely. Actually, while I was there, the next book is set in Belize, in three different time periods, 1012, 2012, and 3012. So 1012 deals with the Maya, or the decline of the Maya. 2012 deals with the current tourist era and like tourist frenzy. And then in 2012, a new religion gets founded inadvertently. And so I realized when I was traveling in Iran that this new religion, now aged 1,000 years and being dealt with in the 3012 portion, will look like Persian Islam. And so while I was traveling, for example, going to the Zirkana, it's basically a Shia Islam show of ritual strength, and the various, and it's men only, and they do these amazing feats of strength, and they are called out by a singer. And I was so energized by being there. Like, I came out and I was almost shaking, and I wanted to like beat my hands against the wall just to get out how much energy I was feeling. And I told my guide Muhammad, I was like, okay, I have the first scene. I have the first scene of the next novel. Like, that was it. And it will be translated, of course, in a way that I can't quite describe yet. I have to write it. But I get that feeling when I'm watching something. I was like, oh, this is going in. And I was getting that feeling the whole time I was in Iran. Like, oh, this needs to be seen and shown and translated. And yeah, so the next novel will have a lot of Persian influence, if not explicitly so, like very implicitly so.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that now.
Thank you.